I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, it didn't, as some nightmares do, go away. In fact, the country's financial crisis got a little stickier over the weekend, with Democrats determined to set terms for the proposed government bailout, as that bailout, the largest of a private industry in the country's history, grew closer to $1 trillion. Today, two Japanese companies bought up portions of Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley. And over the weekend, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, the last two investment banks in the U.S., began converting to regular banks, submitting themselves to Federal Reserve control and regulation. Well, in a few minutes, our conversation today with a former regulator who was in the room when senators, including John McCain, exerted pressure to remove regulations back in the 80s. We'll get his thoughts on today. But first, what's going on? New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn joins us from Washington. And David, the Bush administration wants a vote on the $700 billion bailout by Friday. But that's when Congress is supposed to adjourn for campaigning. So what's the thinking?
Well, it was a hugely busy weekend, and it's going to be an even busier, crazier week on Capitol Hill. Congress has to deal not only with the Treasury's proposed $700 billion bailout for Wall Street, but also with a budget resolution to keep the entire government running, basically until there's a new president. We've already seen some counterproposals. Barney Frank, congressman from Massachusetts, has put forward his demands for what might be added to the Treasury proposal. Senate Democrats are already circulating ideas, but they're expected to weigh in formally with legislative language sometime today. Republicans, of course, will have their demands, and none of this is happening through the normal legislative process. So basically, there'll be a lot of meetings happening. Then Speaker Pelosi and Harry Reid, the majority leader, have got to get their heads together and figure out exactly how they're going to get this done. And they're hoping to do it, as you said, in 4 or 5 days.
Well, tell us more about what Barney Frank has requested. We know he wants to include in the rescue plan limits on CEO pay. He calls it the clawback provision. He also wants more assistance for homeowners and far more oversight of the Treasury Department. Now, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says he wants a clean bill. But what's the thinking that he's going to get it?
Hank Paulson is a realist. The White House understands that not just Democrats, but Republicans in Congress as well, are not about to write the Treasury a $700 billion check and walk away and leave the administration to its own devices, especially because it's going to be a different administration who's largely managing this program. So at the top of the list, both Democrats and Republicans insisting on some greater oversight here, either the Inspector General or General Accountability Office, or even House Republicans have proposed a joint select committee in Congress. But the bottom line is they are just not going to leave this without careful oversight. This entire mess was created because of a lack of careful oversight by government and regulators in Washington, and they're not going to make the same mistake twice. So as this $700 billion is appropriated and the administration starts to spend it to prop up Wall Street firms, Congress and others in Washington will be keeping a close eye.
And hasn't the administration already broadened the bill?
They did. Even if Congress was, the immediate knee-jerk reaction was to say, whoa, 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 there need to be some more controls here. The initial instinct on the Treasury side was actually to expand it further, partly because they realized the initial legislative language that they put forward limited the program to financial institutions headquartered in the United States, and also limited the Treasury's ability to purchase debt to mortgage-related assets. And very quickly, what the Treasury Secretary and presumably the Fed Chairman, Ben Bernanke, realized was that this was a little too narrow and didn't account for the global nature of the economy.
So now they're making foreign companies eligible.
Now, it's really any financial institution, foreign institutions with substantial operations in the United States, and it doesn't have to be mortgage-related debt. It could be any distressed debt. Of course, the focus will certainly be on mortgage-related assets because that's at the core of the credit crisis. But you did have, in less than 24 hours, the administration had revised the plan, and it makes sense. You know, as some lawmakers have pointed out, banks like RBS, UBS, Barclays, these are European-based institutions, but millions of American citizens do business with them right here in the United States. It would be, you know, like suggesting, well, Toyota is a foreign car company, so it has no impact on what Americans drive. I mean, that's just preposterous. And
well, a couple things. President Bush said today that the whole world is watching to see if Congress can do this in the next several days. How is the world reacting, just broadly? How are stocks looking around the world?
I think the little I've seen is that they're headed somewhat lower today. it's clear that part of that change that the Treasury made to include foreign institutions happened because they couldn't guarantee that foreign governments would step forward with their own versions of this rescue, although the administration has asked them for that, and that remains a distinct possibility.
Very briefly, how does the move by Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs to switch from investment banking to regular commercial banks that have all the government regulations that come with that, how does that fit into this picture?
I think that's going to add a sense of urgency. I think that the idea that even as Congress is debating some of these provisions, the situation on Wall Street continues to change very fast will remind everyone in Washington that there isn't time to waste, that certainly they want to do this right, but they need to move quickly. And look, it's a remarkable thing for some of these lawmakers who were lobbied so hard and for so long to limit the regulation of investment banks like Goldman and Morgan Stanley, to now see them rush into the arms of the Fed in some ways, willing to accept much greater regulation and much higher capital requirements in order to protect their core businesses. There's no question it's a huge shift in how Wall Street does business.
Because in exchange for the regulating and the limit on what they can do, they get federal backing.
Right. And one of the more fascinating statistics in the New York Times today is a description of how much capital the investment banks have versus assets. In Goldman's case, I believe the number was a dollar in capital for every $22 in assets, meaning that the difference there is borrowed money. For Morgan Stanley, it was a dollar in capital for every $30 in assets. And when you look at a firm like Bank of America, which at its core is a traditional bank, it's completely reversed. There's $10 in capital for every dollar in assets. So that it's total inverse in terms of how much money they have to have. The days of making humongous bets on risky investments using other people's money seem to be over, at least for the time being.
David Herzenhorn, reporter for The New York Times. David, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
So now there are calls for more regulation of Wall Street. Well, haven't we been here before? Take the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s, the last era of big government bailouts. Back then, more than 700 SNLs were closed or bailed out by the taxpayers to the tune of $125 billion through a government-created entity called the Resolution Trust Corporation. Now some are calling for the establishment of a new government entity to resolve the current crisis. And the SNL crisis was almost the end of John McCain's political career. The Senate rebuked him for using poor judgment and trying to influence regulation on behalf of his personal friend Charles Keating, the chair of Lincoln Savings and Loan. McCain has called the Keating Five scandal the worst mistake of his life, and last week business writer David Leonhardt told us in Judging McCain Today we should look ahead and not back. Well, joining us on the line from Kansas City is William Black. He was in the room when McCain tried to pressure regulators. In fact, he was one of them. Bill Black is now an associate professor at the University of Missouri, but he was a senior regulator during the savings and loan crisis, so disliked that Charles Keating told his lobbyists to tell politicians to get Black, kill him dead. Not surprisingly, Bill Black went on to write the book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with present day. Do you agree that John McCain shouldn't be judged by the Keating Five scandal? You've said he was part of a bigger culture.
He was part of a bigger culture. After all, the other four senators in the room were Democrats, and Speaker Wright, who Charles Keating also used to put political pressure on the agency, was also a Democrat. So it was certainly a bipartisan effort to intimidate regulators. I think that means that it's highly relevant to the future.
Well, and we want to look ahead, but we should say that one of the Democrats in the Keating Five was Dennis DeConcini, also of Arizona. And he says John McCain got a free ride, that John McCain was the most culpable of the senators because he was the closest to Keating, taking rides on Keating's private jet to the Bahamas and things like that.
Well, he was the most culpable in a number of ways. He was the only one of the senators that had a personal financial stake in the dispute. His wife and his father-in-law stood to lose a significant amount of money if we enforced the direct investment rule. And the entire purpose of the meeting was to pressure us not to take enforcement action against the Lincoln's massive violation of the direct investment rule to the tune of over $600 million.
Well, let's go back and explain what that rule is and put this all in the context of the time. The savings and loans were what they said, places to save your money or get a loan. What was happening to them in this time?
In the early 80s, there was widespread deregulation of savings and loans. And indeed, they were given powers far beyond what commercial banks could invest in. And the principal thing that was new that a commercial bank couldn't do was something called a direct investment. And that's a situation where instead of loaning money, you actually buy the asset. In this case, say a huge office building or a bunch of raw land in Arizona.
So let's see. The SNL had been deregulated. They had this power now to buy buildings and such. And you and other regulators want to take that power away because of concerns about capital and how secure these banks are by enforcing this new direct investment ban. What was that?
Well, the direct investment rule was part of the great re-regulation effort in the mid-1980s. There was a new chairman, Chairman Gray, of the regulatory agency. He saw that there was a disaster emerging, and he sought to re-regulate the industry.
Well, and Charles Keating tried to get rid of that rule through legislation. He failed and enlisted friendly senators, including McCain. There was John Glenn, Dennis DeConcini, Alan Cranston, Ronald Reagle, to meet with regulators. You were present at the second of two meetings. What happened?
Well, the same thing happened that happened in the first meeting, and that is the senators pushed us not to take enforcement action against Lincoln Savings for this massive violation of the direct investment rule to the tune of over $600 million. And let me emphasize, there was a lot of experience by the time of these meetings, which were in April of 1987, with what happened when you had substantial amounts of direct investment. And every single savings and loan that had done so had failed. This stuff was financial cyanide. For example, we told them that we had looked at 52 of the largest loans by Lincoln Savings, and there wasn't even the very first thing you would do before making a loan, do a credit check. It were zero for 52. We thought that would be devastating to senators. Instead, they attacked us. It was the most amazing thing you can imagine. They had really drunk the Kool-Aid.
Bill Black, we want to take a break and compare the SNL bailout to the proposed one today. But before we move on, sum up that chapter in regulation. What are the lessons learned, or maybe unlearned, from the SNL crisis? Maybe something people don't realize.
I'll tell you the biggest thing that Senator McCain, then Representative McCain, tried to do. The administration attempted to give Charles Keating control over the federal agency regulating savings and loans. It was a three presidential appointees, and they were going to appoint two members chosen by Charles Keating. And Senator McCain was not only aware of that effort, but supportive of that effort. Had that occurred, the savings and loan crisis, instead of being $125 to $150 billion, would have been over $1 trillion easily, and it probably would still be our worst political scandal in history. And it came incredibly close.
That's former regulator Bill Black. Okay, let's do move on. When we return, the parallels between the SNL bailout and today's proposed one. Also later, the connection between that baby formula in China and bad pet food in the U.S. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from University of Missouri Professor Bill Black, a federal financial regulator during the last financial meltdown, the savings and loan crisis of the 80s. And Bill, a lot of what you've been saying about the SNL crisis sounds familiar today. You talk about SNL banks that, after deregulation, started to expand their lending powers, making real estate deals without government oversight or regulation, without enough capital on hand. As today's crisis unfolds, does it sound familiar to you?
Oh, absolutely. And it's even more direct than that. After all, there were subprime loans. There was terrible lack of underwriting. And we stopped all of that by regulation. And those regulations were gotten rid of, and they produced the new crisis in subprime. And then the same major problem that we identified, which was accounting fraud, was repeated in the current crisis. So, yes, it's incredibly parallel.
When were the regulations that were instituted after the savings and loan crisis taken away?
They were taken away in the 90s.
Well, what about other comparisons being made between now and then? Some are calling for the same kind of response, but when those SNLs or banks failed, the government simply took them over. Today, the government is paying for them. Isn't that different?
Well, no, the savings and loans were insured institutions. So we paid as taxpayers to resolve those as well. What's different today is that we have taken massive types of financial institutions that didn't have any deposit insurance, and we've extended federal guarantees to them. So these are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and AIG. Failures were never supposed to be covered by the taxpayers, but now they are being covered, and this is to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars.
Well, Joe Nocera writes in the New York Times this weekend that there's another difference between then and now, and that's that most of the assets from the S&L crisis were real estate, which had value. The government ended up selling off casinos and hotels through this Resolution Trust Corporation. Today, the assets are these complex derivatives. Nobody knows their value, and firms are going to be selling them to the government. Nobody really knows their worth. It seems much more complicated.
It is more complicated, but two things at root are, again, the same. Most of these things at root are supposedly backed by mortgages, but a different kind of mortgage, subprime and such, that is likely to have far less value. The second thing that is the same is the way you do accounting fraud is to find assets that don't have a clearly verifiable asset value, because then it's easy to inflate those value. You create phony accounting income and you hide real losses. So it's the same dynamic, but with slightly different ammunition this time.
So what do you think of calls for another entity like the Resolution Trust Corporation?
Well, it's ironic that there is this call for a Resolution Trust Corporation, particularly from Senator McCain, because this is what the last Resolution Trust Corporation said about Senator McCain in paragraph 119 of its racketeering complaint against Charles Keating. The improper use of political influence protracted the examination process and afforded Keating additional time in which to exacerbate their frauds. The political influence they're referring to, of course, is the Keating Five.
So you're saying that John McCain is calling for the same kind of oversight now that he managed to put off when he intervened on behalf of Charles Keating back then?
Yes, he actually was exactly on the wrong side of the issues. And this is someone, Charles Keating, who was really easy to figure out. And unlike the other senators, Senator McCain was a close personal friend for years. Charles Keating was a guy who was arrogant, nasty, openly bigoted, bragged about using his political power to create these kind of interventions. And that's who Senator McCain had the judgment to be a close personal friend of, and then to help him in this effort that cost an extra $2 billion.
But John McCain has called that the worst mistake of his life. Do you think that he or the party that he leads right now, the Republicans, have learned from that mistake?
No, they've gutted again the accounting rules. They've gutted again the rules on underwriting. They've deregulated, and they put the worst possible supervisors in who didn't believe in regulation, wanted to destroy it. The head of the Office of Thrift Supervision, James Gillerin, went to a press conference with a chainsaw to emblemize how much he hated regulation and was going to destroy it. Well, he succeeded, and with it, he destroyed hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money. When you allow substantial accounting fraud, you will create financial bubbles, because that's what a Ponzi scheme does. And those bubbles will crash and burn, and they will take with it a big chunk of the economy.
You mentioned the chainsaw that was used in the past. You've told us that there's another implement that caught your attention.
Yes, at the one of the featured speakers at the recent Republican convention said that they were going to take a weed whacker to regulation. So they apparently like this metaphor of destroying regulation, but they don't understand the cost to the people.
We just want to ask one last thing. You mentioned McCain. But the deregulation that had been set up in the wake of the S&L was, as you pointed out, overturned in the late 90s, including one law in 1999 that was signed into law by Bill Clinton. So is there a little bit of blame to go around?
Oh, absolutely. One of the leaders in fighting against effective supervision against securities fraud, for example, was Senator Lieberman. At the time he was taking the lead, he was a Democrat. So, yes, there have been major times when important Democrats have taken efforts to support the people that are engaged in the accounting fraud.
We mentioned the members of the Keating Five who are Democrat, and yet backers of Bill Clinton, we should say, would say that it was a Republican Congress and he didn't have the votes to override that law in 1999.
That's probably true. Certainly another major thing that was done is that Congress made it far harder to bring a civil suit against accounting and securities fraud. And that one was actually passed over President Clinton's veto.
William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, who was a senior federal savings and loan regulator during the S&L crisis in the late 1980s. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here Now, you can bet we'll have the latest on the financial picture, but also why the late pianist Glenn Gould still matters nearly 45 years after he stopped performing, 26 years after his death. That's tomorrow. And after the news, what is melamine and why is it still in Chinese baby food when we know it killed pets? That's after the news, Here and Now. The head of the agency in charge of the safety of China's food supply has resigned over the growing tainted baby formula scandal. Four babies have reportedly died and over 50,000 are ill because of the industrial chemical melamine, which causes kidney stones and kidney failure, and which it now appears was known to be in the formula. Central China Television is reporting that complaints about the baby formulas were made as early as December of 2007, but the manufacturers didn't act on those complaints, nor did they report them to the government. Melamine has now been found in infant formula and milk products from 22 of China's dairy companies. Now, these products have never come to the U.S., and they've now been pulled off shelves in China, but they and other Chinese exports are being banned across Asia. Well, Marion Nessel is not surprised. She's a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, also the author of a number of books on food safety and politics. In her latest, Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine, Marion goes through a step-by-painful-step analysis of last year's pet food crisis, how melamine-tainted wheat gluten from China poisoned and killed maybe thousands of cats and dogs in the U.S. And Marion joins us in the studio. So you are now very familiar with melamine, the same ingredient in the baby formula. What is it?
Melamine is an organic compound that has a lot of nitrogen in it. And if you add it to various kinds of substances, it makes it look like those substances have a lot of protein because the test for protein looks for nitrogen. It doesn't really test protein directly. So this artificially boosts the protein content and has been used for decades fraudulently to do that.
What do you think of the current story in China? Because you wrote in the book that the pet food crisis actually, you know, ultimately may have had a good effect in that it mobilized China. They sent out 33,000 inspectors. They executed one of their food and drug inspectors. But it seems as if the story goes on.
The story goes on. They have a big problem to get under control. Most of the food in China is produced in small backyard operations, 80% of them. It's a very big country. They've never had food and drug laws. They need them very badly, and they need them right away.
Yeah. Well, and why, given that, is the U.S. pet industry so dependent on China? I mean, explain a little bit about what you discovered about the global reality of pet food.
Well, the pet food recalls, I think, were the subtitle of the book is Chihuahua in the Coal Mine for a very, very good reason. This was an early warning of the kinds of problems that we're going to have in our own food supply for people. The things that happened as a result of the recall were revelations that pet foods were made in one place, that surplus pet food was fed to pigs, chickens, and fish.
Well, let's take one of those at a time, that pet foods were made in one place. There was one company in particular, Menu Foods, that made the food for a number of brands.
100 brands.
And as you found out, with very little difference between any of them.
Well, the differences were subtle. And the ingredients for those pet foods, I think of it as like a chef who has piles of ingredients out on the table in front and puts a little bit of this and that in. It worked pretty much the same way. One of those ingredients was wheat gluten, which is a protein binder that kind of holds the ingredients in pet foods together. And the wheat gluten used to be made in the United States, but it's gotten too expensive. So companies started getting it from companies in Asia, one of which was in China. and the Chinese, some very clever Chinese entrepreneur, substituted melamine because it was a lot cheaper to do that.
And yet, you're saying this all now, but this trail was kind of hard to find. I mean, you have charts and graphs and timelines in the book to show with arrows and how...
Yes, and they were very difficult to do.
Right. One of the things you discovered, for instance, is that there was a silk manufacturing or a company that claimed to be selling silk scarves.
One of the ingredients in pet food was fraudulently shipped through them.
Let me read their name, because this is, as you write, the wonderfully named Suzhou Textiles Silk Light Industrial Products Arts and Crafts Import and Export Company.
Isn't that great?
But, you know, apparently they were a scarf export company that was, you know, just using that as a front to really just ship this tainted wheat gluten.
Yes, and there was another ingredient involved, rice protein concentrate. Same deal. It was melamine plus wheat flour. And it was shipped through another textile company in order to avoid having the substance inspected. So there were lots of fraudulent things going on here.
So a lot of the American companies that ultimately were involved in this really sincerely did not know, you know, where some of the products were coming from, how they might be coming in. And you document how hard it was for scientists to even track down what the problem was.
Well, it was hard to figure out that it was melamine, although I think they should have figured it out a lot sooner because it's been around a long time.
Who knew what when? Now, you write that Menu Foods didn't contact the FDA until a month after they knew animals were dying.
Yeah, the story began with some sick cats, and the owners of those cats looked at the phone number that was on the cans and called that phone number. That phone number somehow got to Menu Foods, which was the original contract manufacturer for the product. And Menu Foods started hearing about problems with sick cats at least 3 weeks before they actually did the recall. And the only reason they did the recall was because one of the products that they were making was IAMS, which is a product that belongs to Procter & Gamble. And IAMS customers called Procter & Gamble. Procter & Gamble has a much more efficient system in place for dealing with this sort of thing. When they got their second call, they knew they had a problem. They called Menu Foods and said, "What's going on?" Menu Foods said, "You know, we changed our wheat gluten supplier."
And you think?
Procter & Gamble said, "We're doing a recall, and you better do one too, because we're going to do one."
Well, let's be clear here. The FDA has no authority to order a recall.
The FDA has no authority to order recalls. All it can do is ask companies to do them voluntarily.
And how long before the FDA did that?
It's hard to know exactly where the FDA was in this because there were three things going on. There was Menu Foods, Procter & Gamble, which was pushing very hard to get this stuff recalled, and the FDA trying to figure out. And nobody knew about melamine at that point.
They just knew
that cats were dying.
Yeah.
And they had no idea why. They couldn't see anything that was obvious.
And dying. I mean, there was kidney failure.
It's kidney failure. It's horrible.
Terrible.
It's horrible. And when you think about these babies in China who are dying because melamine is in milk, in diluted milk, to make the milk look as if it has as much protein as it's supposed to, it really is very upsetting. And I thought the pet food recalls were a sign to everybody that every single one of these ingredients should be checked.
Well, and eventually they did through you, as you always do, tell us all the details of how they actually tracked it to the melamine. And so now we have huge recalls across the country. The FDA, as you write, really underestimated how people felt about their pets. This was the most response they've ever had on their phone lines?
Oh, never. Did the FDA ever get this kind of... There were at least 17,000 or 18,000 phone calls of people reporting sick or dying pets or not knowing what to do, and the FDA was not equipped to handle it. Neither was Menu Foods, which got 200,000 phone calls. One of the things that I found as I was working on this book was this sort of attitude is, oh, they're just cats and dogs.
Well, people really love their pets, but you had other concerns. That's Marion Nessel, and you are listening to Here and Now. Marion, your book is Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine, and you write that people were missing the Chihuahua in the coal mine part of this, of the pet food crisis. Again, their thinking was, oh, these are just cats and dogs' pets.
But if this could happen to pets, it could happen to anybody. It's the same food supply. And one of the really, I mean, there were many astonishing things that happened during the recall. One was the business of feeding surplus pet foods to pigs and chickens. I didn't know that. Or the same ingredients that go into pet foods go into fish feed. Who knew?
And people eat fish.
And people eat fish. And people eat pigs and chickens that were fed melamine-tainted pet food.
So, by the way, has there been any record of this melamine-caused kidney failure working its way into a human?
Yes. There was no question that the pigs in particular that had been fed melamine-tainted pet food had already been sold by the time they found out about this and people had eaten them. But fortunately, the amount of melamine was so diluted by the time it got into people that it didn't do any harm. But that's not what's happening in these infants.
Horrible story. But, you know, again, you write that, you know, what might happen for China is the same thing that happened in the U.S. or around the time, you know, Upton Sinclair, as you write, documented it in
the jungle. I don't think we should be too xenophobic about China. What's going on in China is exactly what went on in the United States before we had food and drug laws. In fact, as a result of this kind of behavior, the food and drug laws were passed.
Decades ago.
Decades ago, 1906. Mm-hmm.
So give China a chance, perhaps, to have the same, you know, arc that we in the U.S. have had with this story. But how is the U.S. doing now? I mean, as a result of the pet scare?
Well, there's some things that are happening that I think are consoling. One is that pet food companies have gotten their act together, and many of them are doing testing, are resourcing their ingredients, or paying attention to where their ingredients are coming from. It also exposed problems in the FDA, and we don't have a food safety system in this country that covers our food from farm to table. And the result of that are these endless, horrible recalls of tomatoes, or was it jalapeno peppers? Or was it cilantro or peanut butter? I mean, we don't even know what it was in that tomato one. And the inability of the country to get a grip on how food production works and to have a food safety system that covers food from farm to table is something that we're badly lacking and very much need, I think.
Does it just need an overhaul of the agency? This is the time when we're talking about more regulation. Does it just need tougher rules, more staff, more ability to act out, to act on something?
Well, it needs all of the above. And the Government Accountability Office has for decades now been saying that what this country needs is a single food safety agency that's separate from drugs. And I see that Rosa DeLauro, who's a congresswoman from Connecticut, has just proposed such a thing. She's not the first person to have done that, but she's one of the most active legislators on food safety issues.
And meanwhile, what about China?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin. It's a very big country with a very big problem. And we've seen since the recalls, the pet food recalls, we had that terrible incident. Fraudulent producers were putting chondroitin sulfate into this drug and calling it heparin because it tested the same way. And now we have this infant formula, which I hope is scary enough and upsetting enough and is causing enough uproar among the mothers of these single children. Mm-hmm. Remember, we have one child policy in China. So this is a very, very big loss. Will be a wake-up call to the Chinese that they really have to get a grip on this. 18 months ago, they promised that they would clean up their Food Safety Act. They went to an enormous amount of trouble at the time, but they've either backslid or they haven't been able to get a grip on it. They have to, or people won't buy things from China.
That's Marion Nessel. Her latest book is Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine. Marion, thanks so much for talking to us about the pet food scare of last year and, of course, this terrible story out of China, the sick babies going on right now. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here.
And you can get more information about Marion and her book, Pet Food Politics, by going to our website, here-now.org. We'll, of course, continue to follow the story out of China for you. But coming up, Handel for a Headbangers, new music from the East Village Opera Company, in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. Hey!
we're fighting for.
Wagner or Led Zeppelin?
Hands on tight, hands on clean, hands that hit the coal machine.
Maybe both. The Ride is the opening track on the East Village Opera Company's latest venture into rock meets aria. The group channels, if you will, what Richard Wagner's Valkyrie might sound like if he were writing and performing today. Their new CD is called Old School, and on it, the East Village Opera Company puts classics from Wagner, Handel, Puccini, Mozart, Verdi, and Bach through rock's classic prism. Joining us from the Argo Studios in New York is Peter Kaiserwalter. He's the group's arranger. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Robin.
Also instrumentalist. And Tylee Ross, who handles lead vocals. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having us on.
Well, Peter, let's take the song The Ride, mixing Wagner's Valkyrie and Led Zeppelin's Black Dog. Now, how do you approach these arrangements?
Take the score from the composer, set it aside, don't look at it, and start with the lyric and the melody and take it from there. You know, we're just playing old music on new instruments.
Well, let's stay with Wagner, you know, sort of in essay form. Wagner, Led Zeppelin, discuss.
Well, in the Valkyries, Wagner's writing about Norse mythology. That opera was premiered in 1871, and exactly 100 years later, Led Zeppelin is on their second and third records, are using Norse mythology as their main thematic material. They're also overblown, massive right. Spectacles. There's really a lot of similarities between the sort of arena rock of the late 60s, early 70s, and opera as we know it.
Let's listen to another one of your songs. This is King of the Night. It's your reimagining of Mozart's aria Queen of the Night from The Magic Flute. Let's listen. Tylee, the twist here, this aria is usually sung by a woman, a soprano. Here, you take the lead. And here's where it feels as if you've been listening to Freddie Mercury. I mean, it's not Queen of the Night, it's Queen.
I think any guy who's going to sing as high as you're kind of called upon to sing, singing that song, is going to sound a little bit like Frankie Mercury. It's going to sound a lot like Freddie Mercury because he was just, you know, he sat up so high,
yeah.
So much of the time.
And when you hear your songs, you know, you realize you're really struck by how thin a membrane there is between big rock operas and true opera.
When we first started, the goal wasn't to take opera songs and turn them into rock songs. Our launching off point was to ask ourselves, how might these composers treat these if they had the instruments that we have and the musical awareness that we have of world music and all the different styles of music that have come along since the era of classical? How might these composers have treated this if they're writing the same melody today? And when you're talking about the membrane that separates opera from rock, I think the membrane is just a temporal membrane. It's just it's a membrane of 150 years of neglect by popular music listeners.
Right, right.
And once you peel that off and you stick electric guitars into the orchestra and percussion and drums where the timpani sits, then you've basically got a rock band.
Let's listen to another track. This is Walk. It was inspired by Handel's Semele. Let's listen. What happens When you're playing? I mean, can you see...
People go bananas. I've never seen audiences... I've been playing my whole life, but they go a little cuckoo in theaters or in clubs. And often it's in a place where people might not be that familiar with us, or there's a lot of skeptical people, and I would be one of them if someone dragged me to see a band that combines rock and opera. I probably wouldn't go. But so there's a bit of winning over that we have to do, and usually by the middle of the set, it certainly feels that we've done that to an audience that is demographically the most diverse I've ever experienced.
Well, let's remind ourselves, you know, why they might react in the way they do. We've been assuming a lot that people know the original, so let's just hear a little bit of soprano Kathleen Battle singing the aria Jove Assist Me from Handel's Semele. Hear her first. And now the East Village Opera Company's interpretation.
Something you should understand. Jove and Pip. Oh, I love my freaky wonderland. Jove and Pip. The trip behind my every mistake. I start to break.
We want to jump in to say that is not Ty Lee singing. That is the East Village Opera Company's Anne-Marie Milazzo singing Help Me, Jove, in Pity.
That's one track on that record that there, a lot of liberties were taken. That one's sort of more inspired by the original aria than it is like an arrangement of it. But all that to say, there are elements from the original in there, but they're kind of hard to hear in that version that we do.
That's Peter Kieswalter and Ty Lee Ross, co-founders of the group East Village Opera Company, or EVOC. Their new CD is called Old School.
That's old with an E.
Sure. And for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org, and we leave you. I mean, what's a segment on opera arias without a duet? We leave you with their version of Puccini's Madame Butterfly. It's called the Butterfly Duet. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.